You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi, I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome to our second live show broadcast from the Jerome L. Green Space. Coincidentally, this is also the second in our series called Food in the City, and today we will be exploring what a chef looks for at a green market. If you're at the Union Square Farmers Market and you happen to see a guy on a long customized bicycle with a large shopping cart in front of it, that's Chef Peter Hoffman making his rounds. Later that day, he'll be cooking what he buys at the market in his two restaurants, Savoy at 70 Prince Street and Back 40 on 12th and Avenue B. Peter Hoffman has been a presence in the markets for years now, and in the process, he's developed relationships with many of the farmers. He has also developed a skill for choosing great produce, and I'm glad that he could join me now to share some of his hard-earned knowledge. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to our show.
Nice to be here.
Can you even remember when you started shopping at farmers markets?
I have a vague memory of discovering, it was actually Karen Hubert who pointed me over
to
the market.
An old friend of mine as well.
Sadly, no longer here, but... I was working at a restaurant called Hubert's, named after her, and it was on 22nd Street, and the market was just down the way, had started maybe a year or so before, and she said, oh, there's great, great things over there. You've got to go check it out. And so that was really the beginning for me of seeing that that there was product available that was not coming through the conventional food stream and that there were treasures there.
Were there other chefs already shopping there?
Oh, I don't know, actually. It was not long after that. There were two or three people that we started to see, but it really is only in the last couple of years, I don't know, 5, 10, that really chefs from all over the city have been coming down to the markets to shop.
Of course, the markets were a lot more modest in those days, and there was less selection, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the growth of... The expansion of product and the diversity has grown enormously over those 30 years of the market. I mean, in the beginning, they were kind of traditional farmers growing tomatoes and peppers and onions, things like that. And then people started to see, well, there's all kinds of things that people are interested in. Somebody like Kenny Migliarelli started to show up, and he was growing arugula, and that nobody knew what arugula was. That was just an Italian vegetable.
I thought that it was a Jewish dessert. Oh, that's arugula.
Yeah, good stuff, too.
Hmm. If it's made well.
But, you know, so that people started to see wasn't just ethnic food, that these were foods that were of interest to lots of people.
So people started asking the farmers for things, and the farmers started bringing in things that people didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that affect you? You'd see something new in the market and say, I've got to try that?
Sure. You know, that's the beginning point of inspiration, is to see something wonderful in the market. And that might be, that wonderful thing might be... This is a product I know, and it's really fresh and looks fabulous. And it also might be, this is new. What is this? I've never seen it before. And
what do you do with that? Do you ask the farmer how you prepare it, or do you? I'm sure you have 1,000 cookbooks.
Yeah, you can start with that. You go back to the cookbooks and see. I mean, it's just like again, Kenny Migliarelli started selling basically a particular variety of squash. Runners, I mean, gugozza is what it's called in Sicilian. So who knew what they were? Some Sicilians knew what they were. So you say, well, what do I do with these? And then you experiment. It's a simple sauté, essentially. But there's a new product. What can we do? And I think that for me, that exploration, that expression, whether it's in my home or in the restaurant, to say, God, there's a million different things to eat. Or lots of different ways to cook, and that's a very exciting process and expansion that we can give to ourselves in a world where over and over our experience is about narrowing, that there's less There's less things available to us. It's not just narrowing of biodiversity, but cultural diversity as well. And so that one of my goals is to say, there's a lot of things to eat. Let's enjoy that.
Have you ever told a farmer, I think you should try to grow this thing. I saw it in Europe, or I saw it somewhere else.
I've done that. I've brought seeds back and given them.
You give them seeds?
Them. Oh, yeah. Sort of trips to Europe to bring back certain things. Go to the and
like what?
Well, I've done two things, and then one that wasn't seeds that come to mind. One is a sort of like purple carrots or something. I mean, you see them around now, but I brought seeds back, I don't know, 10 years ago or something, and gave them to Alex Paffenroth. And another is this whole thing that I do at the restaurants, the calzotada, which is this grilled wintered over leek festival that we do at both restaurants in the spring. And the calçots, they're kind of like leeks, but a little bit different, slightly different variety. And so I've brought those seeds back and given them to three or four farmers.
Now, there are a lot of people who are afraid to talk to the farmers because they don't feel that they are knowledgeable enough. Should they be intimidated?
No, I find them incredibly friendly people wanting to talk about their product. They're proud.
And they know how to cook everything they grow?
Not necessarily, actually. I think that they're, you know, it's interesting to see which farmers really live off of their produce or what they're producing or growing, whatever, and which don't. And you can get a sense that some people are it is still just an occupation for them and not fully integrated into their lives. And sometimes you actually can sense that in the quality of the work.
My guest is Peter Hoffman, who is the chef owner of two restaurants. For a long time, it was just Savoy at 70 Prince Street, and then he also became co-owner of Back 40 on the Far East Side, 190 Avenue B at 12th Street. And this is the second in our Food in the City series. We're talking about going to the farmer's market. My problem is always trying to figure out what is the best thing. And I usually go for looks, of course. When I lived in Chinatown, it dawned on me one day that when I bought a head of broccoli, that head of broccoli had already been picked up and rejected by 2,000 Chinese women. And so I wasn't sure whether I was getting the right one, but they seemed to know something I didn't know.
Huh. Well, I'm sure you know a lot, Lenny, about picking good vegetables and fruits. My experience in the market is still one of exploration, asking the question. You know, we've gotten so used to in our society, in the supermarket world, of thinking like, oh, they're the beans, they're the strawberries, that's the product. You know, a rose is a rose is a rose, and in fact, it's not. And so that on any one day, you can go into the market and there's five different people growing strawberries. Well, which one are you going to buy? I have to taste. I have people who I like better, who I have a historical experience with, whether it's personally or based on the product. But even so,
they just
weather
let you
conditions
taste it?
Change and. Yeah, they're always giving out samples. I mean, you've got a mountain of string beans. What's someone going to say when you eat one?
Well, one of the things that you dealt with was strawberries in this visit to the market that we have filmed. You went there with Benjamin Walker from our culture department, and you explained the difference between East and West Coast strawberries. Let's look at the clip. Let's hope we can look at the clip.
The weather's what's in control of this. The fruit, the plant just sucks up water. And so it holds the water, and that makes the berry grow really fast. So that one of the reasons why a California berry can get, you know, so huge, some of it is selection, but some of it is lots of irrigation, and you just give them a big, big drink, and they balloon up. You know, what we want is a slow-growing berry because it's going to have more intense flavor. Very good, though.
Yeah, by the way, you can see the complete Peter Hoffman video on the Food in the City webpage on wmyc.org/food. Now, I've wondered about those California strawberries because they often have this big, pulpy, white center. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, is that just because they are just sopping with water, and that takes away the flavor? Or have they been picked before they were really ready?
I don't know whether the open core is... I don't think it's about being picked before they were ready. I think some of it may actually also be about selection of varieties. But as I said, irrigation plays a big part, and at the moment, here in New York, we're a little over-irrigated for June.
The farmers haven't wanted that, but that's what's happening.
Exactly. That's the way it's happening at this moment. So I brought you two varieties of strawberries, and they tell interesting stories. One is a traditional berry grown in New Jersey. It's pretty good, or I think it's pretty good, but you can taste a little bit that there's a slight wateriness to it and maybe not quite enough sunlight to develop the sugar. The other you can see is a much smaller berry. It's a very interesting tale also, Lenny, smell them both.
This is radio.
I know. The other ones are known as day neutral, or tri-stars is the particular variety. And the day neutral continues to flower after the days start getting shorter. So next weekend is the summer solstice. June berries, typical strawberries, will stop flowering as the day gets shorter. This variety was an interesting cross, and we'll have local strawberries in August, September, October.
Now the second one smells better, smells more like strawberry, and
yep.
Tastes better as well.
Right. But you can see number one, this is the biggest berry that there is, which is sort of like, I don't know, as big as my thumb, and most of the berries are even smaller, this size of a nickel. And yet you have incredible texture and intensity of flavor in those berries.
I've always had a concern about pesticides, and I have asked around the green markets for pesticide-free berries because they sop up water, they sop up pesticides, and you sometimes can taste the pesticide as well. And it's not so easy to find berries that don't have pesticides because they're so vulnerable.
Right.
And the farmers feel that if they want to bring in a decent crop, they're going to have to spray them.
Well, one of the things, particularly with the traditional berry, is that they have to do very heavy weed control. And the people who grow the day neutrals actually don't keep the plant from year to year. They will plow them under.
More expensive.
It is more expensive, and you pay... At times, you can pay double the price for those berries, but...
So this is the larger one, and this is the day neutral, right?
Right.
This is this is called again? Jersey?
No, I didn't tell you
Jersey
what it was
driver,
called. I mean,
it's
just grown by a grower that we like from New Jersey.
Well, I would be thrilled with this if I didn't have this.
Right, exactly.
And I guess that's part of the secret. Do they ever complain that you've taken one of the berries or some other vegetable and tasted it?
They
know you. Well, what, would they be as nice with me?
I think so. I think people are tasting all the time. Two things about that, Lenny. One is that the other thing when
here
you
comes
taste,
Hoffman. Let's cover up everything.
Right.
He's going to eat all of our food.
When you taste those berries too, and you compare them to what the California berries are, it's like these are far more delicate in texture. So they can't live for 3 weeks traveling across the country. That's another thing that people select for when they grow the industrial berry. These are wonderful in their in their mouthfeel.
Would you say that local always tastes better? Because it's
no,
been...
I don't actually think that. I think that there are traditional growers or conventional growers in our region, and some of the stuff isn't so great. You still have to taste, or you have to ask the questions, and you have to think about how it's being produced.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more with Peter Hoffman, executive chef owner of Savoy at 70 Prince Street and co-owner of Back 40 at 190 Avenue B at 12th Street. This is the second in our Food in the City series. You're listening to the Leonard Bilkley Show on WNYC. We're back with Peter Hoffman, executive chef owner of Savoy and co-owner of Back 40. two restaurants here in the city and as part of our Food in the City series. And by the way, you can see the whole video of Peter Hoffman shopping on our show page at WNYC.org. Tell us about how you came to have beehives on the rooftop of your house here in Manhattan.
Yep. Well, there's an apiarist at the Green Market, Dave Stokes. Berkshire Berries is the name of his outfit. And I started to see that he had a label called New York City Rooftop Honey and talked to him about his tale. And he told me that, in fact, the biggest yields he's ever gotten from a hive was from the Upper West Side.
Better than the Berkshires?
Better than the Berkshires,
even
right?
Though there are so many flowers up there?
Well, you know, in fact, there's a lot of deep green forest, but not necessarily a whole lot of flowering plants that producing nectar. And so the people who have gardens, city gardens, all of that, and all those spaces are irrigated. So they're in great shape, so that you can have a drought up in the Berkshires and nothing's happening. So I was fascinated with that, asked him whether he'd be interested in putting a hive on the roof of my residence, asked my the other people that lived in my building if they were open to that idea. And so actually this is the eighth year that we have bees up on the roof, and we get a little bit of honey off of it every year that he pays us in rent, as mm-hmm. it were.
And does the honey taste better than other honeys?
It's really wonderful honey, you know. And if one could, there, you know, when you go around sometimes and you see that there you can buy linden honey or buckwheat honey, things like that. One of the things that we have actually in the city is that with all the street plantings, there are a whole slew of linden trees. So that if you had a very healthy early spring hive, that is that it went into the winter quite strong, so that it didn't you could take that early honey. You would have linden honey that came from the streets of the city.
That's great. I hope that these bees aren't dying off the way bees are in other parts of the country.
There are issues. We've had to, I think out of the 9 years, they've been I think they've held over and not had to be repopulated about three times. But it's a troublesome time.
How much can you use honey in your cooking? I mean, you can't just substitute it for sugar.
Yeah, I'm not interested in just using it as a substitute for sugar. I know some people will talk about why that's a better thing, but I think that honey as a should stand alone as its own ingredient and own product. And so any number of wonderful things you can do with it, starting with just sort of drizzling it with some cheese that's got some salt and some power as great counterpoint.
We talked earlier about you're going to the green markets when they were first started. Now there are four. Do you go to all four?
What do you mean four?
Aren't there four in the unions? I mean, they're all over town. Four just at Union Square.
Oh, yes. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. I go at least two, probably three times a week.
And are they different?
Well, there are different growers. People who, you know, the smaller markets are Mondays and Fridays, but there's some really extraordinary folks there growing a quality and a diversity that isn't necessarily in the bigger volume Wednesday, Saturday markets.
Do you go with a menu in mind? Do you have a pretty good idea what you'll find?
You know, it's two-sided. That is, we're looking for what's new and coming into season, so then we can take that and bring it back to the restaurant. And then we also know what's happening, and so then we can pick it up.
We have another clip. This involves something I'd never heard of before. Huh? Scapes. Maybe we should watch it and learn
and
more about
scapes. And then I'll tell you about them. Sure.
Scapes. The Great Escape.
There they are. There's the first scape. Yeah, so this is the scape. This is, you can see, this is going to become a flower. It's tender. You can just slice it and sauté it like you would a clove of garlic. You do a stir fry with them and then season them. Really, really versatile, wonderful.
can grill them.
I'm getting a little extra.
You're getting some lessons? That's good. It's a great thing, the garlic scapes.
Now, the scapes are kind of like onions and garlic?
Well, here's what it is. The very best varieties of garlic are what is known as hard-necked garlics, and so they send up a shoot to flower. And that will get stiff and hard and then open as a flower. Now, a farmer doesn't really want the garlic to try to reproduce sexually because they want all the energy, all the plant energy to go into the bulb. So you go along and you cut the scape. You cut the flower off before it matures. Somewhere along the line, people realized that that was edible, that it was sort of a tender, mild garlic-tasting thing. And so they started to cut them and bring them to market and sell them. Here they're called scapes. Out on the West Coast, they call them whistle tops, you know, because they kind of look like that whistle shape. And
you mentioned earlier squash tendrils, the same sort of thing. The Chinese have snow pea pod tendrils that right. I think most people who've eaten them, it's called dao mu or water spinach, I think they also call it, they prefer it actually to the snow peas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But for years, it was not available.
Well, right, it wasn't available, but what's interesting is like it's always been growing. I mean, it's like people who are that close to the land are eating whatever they can wherever the plant is in its life cycle. And so here we are saying, okay, here's the moment for the scapes. They need to be cut. They're not waste.
But what did they do in the past? Did they just throw them away or just cook them in their own kitchens?
Yeah, they just threw them away. They put them in the compost heap. Now they're making money off of them.
The same thing happened with corn that developed a fungus. The Mexicans love it as huitlacoche. Farmers used to throw the stuff out or burn it,
right.
And now they make more money on it.
Right, of course. I mean, it's just like they thought it was a scourge in their fields, and now they can charge $10, $12 a pound for it.
They called it corn smut, in fact. Smut is always a bad word to call anything.
Right.
You won't find any smut in the video that we did with Peter, but you can see the complete video, sexy in its own way, called Food in the City. It's on our Food in the City website.
That's food smut.
Yes. Well, there are some people who talk about food porn, don't they?
They do, right.
And I understand. It's on our webpage at wnyc.org/food, and this is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate talking with Peter Hoffman, who is the, should I say, chef owner of both these restaurants?
Yep.
And you worked at Karen Hubert's. She was a friend as well, a literary person,
right.
Who wound up opening some of the best restaurants in New York, and unfortunately has passed away. But do you see some kind of a link between the two? Because so many of the chefs that I know are literate, turn out to be intellectuals.
Well, it was a very interesting restaurant there in the early 80s. It was a moment both culinarily that it was called, that the term for the cooking at that time was deemed New American Cuisine. Really what that was about discovering the treasures that were here in this country instead of flying in Dover sole from France, but to say we have farmers, we have producers, what are these great products? And so that was the beginning of all of this. And Len and Karen they weren't just cooks or restaurateurs. They were really thinking about the larger cultural context in which it was all set. And they brought in all kinds of cookbook writers, mostly in Brooklyn. I wasn't part of that. But the dinner series that I do at the restaurant in many ways is inspired by them as predecessors.
Now, the French also are thinking that way. When Alain Ducasse was on our show, he said that he loves the stuff that he can get in the United States, and he tries, in his restaurants here, to only use local ingredients, because flying in stuff from France is really just trying to duplicate something, whereas there is a special kind of bounty in this country.
Right, not to mention sort of what you lose in all the handling and traveling time.
Now, a listener from Phoenix, Lily, left a question on our show page. She said, I wanted to bring seeds back from China, but there were restrictions for doing that. Are there not the same restrictions for bringing seeds back from Europe?
Well, I guess I'll admit that I committed contraband once or twice.
But the secret, Lily, is smuggle.
Right. But I didn't actually know that there were issues around seeds. I mean, I've had fruit confiscated from me by the wonderful little beagles at the airport, but but I've never hidden the seeds or actually had them confiscated.
Another listener left a question on our show page. What do you think of the local water, the water from the tap, filtered or not, as a component of local food? While it is a bigger deal in places like San Francisco, a local water movement is burgeoning in New York City because our water supply from the Catskills NYC watershed is some of the best in the world.
I'm not sure what the question is there.
I just read it exactly as it was typed.
I know you did, but I'll just say one of the wonderful things about New York City is the extraordinary quality of the water and the effort that we continue to spend with city money to protect the surrounding farmlands of the reservoir so that the water stays clean, but we have good, healthy farms upstate.
We have some really smart people in our audience, and I'm sure there are a couple of questions here. Anybody have a question for Peter? Well, I think we've answered every question.
There you go.
Oh, okay. I thought for a moment we'd answered every question they could possibly have had. We've covered it all, haven't we, Peter?
We plumbed the depths.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. This is live radio.
No.
Well, maybe we need a different microphone here.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
I just wonder what percentage of the food that you use in your restaurants comes from the green market, and if it's consistent enough both in quality and quantity to do what you need to do in your restaurants, like on an ongoing basis?
Well, percentage varies over the season. Obviously, we're really coming into the time where a tremendous amount of it can come from local farmers. And just to be clear, we buy from farmers who don't come to the green market, so there's people both on Long Island and upstate New York that bring us produce that aren't part of the green market system.
There's a chef who used to have who used to work at Lutes and then
right.
Eberhard Müller, who now has his own farm, and that's what he supplies other restaurateurs.
Right. We buy from him, and then we also buy a great step forward that's occurred in the last, again, sort of 10 to less years is that chefs around the city can buy livestock grown locally. So pigs, lamb, chickens, ducks, all of that year-round is coming into the restaurant produced locally. And
does that affect the quality of the meat, or is it just a matter of philosophy?
Well, right. It's not necessarily, Lenny, about the fact that it was grown locally. It's about what they're growing, what choices they're making about what variety of animal and what the whole manner in which they're raised produces, the difference between okay flavor and something that you put in your mouth and you go, that's extraordinary.
Can I recommend a recipe? Goat with the scape, you can call it scapegoat. Do it.
Yeah, it fell flat, Lenny, but I'll bet if we cooked it together, it'd be delicious.
I bet you if they thought I was a famous stand-up comic, they would have laughed at that. Do we have another question from the audience?
Hi, regarding meat, why does butcher meat usually taste better than supermarket meat? Is it along the same lines that you just mentioned?
Well, big question. I think there are a number of things that can be different. One is that when you talk about butcher meat, it has the possibility that it's been aging in a room, drying and dehydrating, as opposed to sitting in a cryovac bag of blood and stuff and just sort of half rotting in a bloody mess.
But isn't it also more likely to have been cut better?
Well, there's
because
that too.
If you know how to cut the meat right, you can actually bring out more flavor, can't you?
Well, there's that, but if you said, what's the difference between a steak that's in a blister pack and a steak that the guy cut for you at Ottomanelli's on Bleecker Street, I think that some of what they may not be a different breed. It may have not come from a completely different place. But you say choice for choice, because I don't think that buying prime is necessarily what you should be doing. But here are two things. Some of it is that difference, and that it hasn't been, sitting in a plastic bag for 3 weeks.
We are pretty much out of time, but I want to thank you so much. And a reminder that you can see Peter Hoppin's complete video as part of our Food in the City series on our webpage at WNY. In fact, the Food in the City webpage on wnyc.org/food. The next in our series will be on Monday when food writer Melissa Clark, who writes for the New York Times, among other publications, will be talking about cooking in a small apartment. Do you do that at home, or do you have a big kitchen at home?
I have a... It sits in the space of our living dining room area, so you could say it's large, but it's still small in that it's not full of fancy high-end equipment, refrigerators and stoves. It's, a flame, a cutting board, and a refrigerator, you can get a lot done.
Peter, thank you so much for being with us. I'll see you either at one of your restaurants or at the farmer's market. Maybe
Great,
I'll bump
Lenny.
Into you.
Thank you.